Okay, thank you. Thank you. I'm going to talk about observations of black holes. You'll notice that at least the astrophysical conference is about theory confronts reality. I'm the reality bit of that, I hope. I'm not meaning to be rude there, but I'm going to talk about selected observations of black holes, and I was asked to pitch this towards the root mean square string theorist, so I'm going to assume infinite intelligence and zero knowledge about black holes. And in doing so, I'm probably going to insult many astronomers, because I'm just going to talk about a few observations of black holes, or observations of a few black holes. There's lots and lots of other astrophysical, astronomical information that we have, and I'm not going to go through every tiny little bit that we've got. I'm going to start out briefly by talking about black holes in stellar mass binaries, very briefly. I'm going to talk a little bit more about massive black holes in galactic nuclei, and then I'm going to concentrate quite a bit on X-ray ion line observations of some black holes. Just to remind you about observations of gravity and tests and so forth, I don't want to go into this in any depth, but just to put it on an observational basis, and that is to remind you that within the solar system there are lots of nice tests of gravity, solar gravitational deflection, which is 1.75 arc seconds, or 1750 milliarc seconds at the sun's limb. Is 4 milliarc seconds 90 degrees away from the sun. We all, of course, know that that was tested back in 1919 by Eddington and others, but now that's being tested through radio VLBI and also by a ESA satellite, Hipparcos, which has measured the positions of stars across the sky, essentially tested to an accuracy of a fraction of a percent. So all of this is very nice, but it's essentially a weak field test of gravity. There are some strong field tests of gravity, or constraints, which come from binary pulsars. You'll recall the binary pulsar which gave Hulse and Taylor the Nobel Prize. I'm not going to go into details or any details at all about that. Just refer you to a rather old article there. But nevertheless, the evidence for gravitational radiation and so forth from binary pulsars. But I want to get on and talk about black holes, not talk about neutron stars and pulsars. To start off discussing why we might think there are black holes around, this is from a review article by Luminae last year, which to set the context of where black holes might come from, here we've got a plot and its density increases downwards, so denser objects at the bottom, mass increasing to the right. We've got stars across here, ordinary stars burning hydrogen, from a solar mass like the Sun up to perhaps the most massive stars spread across like that. We know from astrophysical observation and also from theory that basically things less than 8 solar masses die, and they move across in this diagram and die as white dwarfs. Stars between about 8 solar masses and about 50 solar masses, this part is rather shaky, will die as neutron stars through a supernova explosion. And objects which start out more massive than that, say a 100 solar mass star, is plausibly going to end its life as a black hole. So there's obvious lots of evidence of stars of these masses. It's likely that we get lots of black holes formed. Just observing those black holes, though, if these start out as single stars and we end up with a single lone black hole, it's going to be very difficult to observe that kind of object just through its very nature as a black hole. One can observe such systems if they form or end up in binary star systems. Recall that at least half of all stars in the sky are members of binary systems. Then, if you've got a black hole, I know it looks like a donut here, but the black hole is in the center here, and it's got a companion star. The companion star, it expands during its stellar evolution to spill matter onto the companion. You get material accreted into the black hole. You can detect that system there as a bright X-ray source. And those X-ray binaries, as we call them, there are plenty of them in the galaxy. And one can study this star, for example, using standard astronomical techniques, and therefore measure what the mass of this companion is. And the standard techniques, of course, are of course to measure the radial velocity of this star and measure it using spectroscopy. And perhaps one of the best examples of such a system which has been studied, and there are many other such systems studied, and I picked this one because it's perhaps the best example, is V404 Cygni. And what we can see here is the radial velocity of its companion through its binary orbital phase. The binary period is slightly longer than a week. What you can see is that the velocity goes, first of all, up here to, it's going away at 200 and something kilometers per second. Then a few days later is coming towards us at a few hundred kilometers per second. This is a very large velocity that the companion star is being swung around at. One can analyze this radial velocity curve and conclude that the mass of the object that the star is going around is at least six solar masses. And when you study the rotational broadening and ellipsoidal modulations, these are just technicalities for the string theorists, but if you study the details of it, you can come up with this plot here of the mass of the primary, the X-ray source, plotted versus the mass of the secondary, the optical star we're studying, and it's around 12 solar masses, plus or minus something like two solar masses. So this means we're studying something which sometimes emits lots of X-rays, it doesn't have the characteristic of an ordinary star, and has a mass of around 12 solar masses. Very good evidence that we're dealing with a black hole. And when you gather the evidence for many of these systems, this is drawn from a review of Phil Charles, who's going to be talking to us later in the week about these systems. I plotted the mass of the X-ray source versus the mass of the optical companion around them, and here we've got various masses. This is V404 Cygni, and you can see they cluster around, shall we say, 10 solar masses. Very good evidence that these are objects of black holes, because it's thought that the maximum mass for a neutron star, the typical mass of neutron stars measured from binary systems, is around 1.4 solar masses, but it's thought that the maximum mass of a neutron star is around 3 solar masses. It depends upon exactly what you assume about the equation of state and the spin of the neutron star, etc., etc., but there is no known simple state of matter which will get you a 12 solar mass compact star, other than that it is a black hole. So this is very good evidence that we're dealing with black holes, and so we think there are plenty of black hole systems in our own galaxy. I'm now going to move on from the stellar mass systems to talk about massive black holes, such as are common, we think they're common, in galactic nuclei. This is a plot which I got off the web last week, just to emphasize how, from an astronomical point of view, studying the centers of galaxies is complicated. This is a radio map of the center of our galaxy. The plane of our galaxy, which is a large spiral galaxy, lies across here, and here we can see various supernova remnants, the remnants of exploded stars. You can see all sorts of arcs and filaments and so forth. The key point about this very complicated pit plot, we're not interested in all the details of it, is that there is a bright radio source coincident with the dynamical center of the galaxy. This is Sagittarius A. Sagittarius A star is a small point-like radio source which lies precisely on the dynamical center of our galaxy. Studies have been made of the galactic center by Genzel and his colleagues, and also by Goetz and her colleagues at UCLA, and I now want to review the evidence that in the center of our galaxy, the galactic center, there is a massive black hole. This, and I'll show several pictures like this, this is just one picture of the center of our galaxy. It's difficult to study because we lie in this galaxy and it's a spiral planar-like galaxy, and we're looking through all the dust and gas and stars in the way to the galactic center. So it's a very crowded region, but nevertheless, using infrared techniques, you can take pictures like this of the center of the galaxy. Sagittarius A star is round about here, and what has been done is to take sequences of images over the years between 92 and now, essentially, and study the motion of the stars. Because as you get closer and closer to the center of the galaxy, so you find that the stars appear to move from image to image. And this is one map of what is happening on a large scale, and this is a map of what's happening on the small scale centered around here. We'll come to that just a bit more in a minute. This is just the quality of the data. You can see error bars on this showing the proper motions, the motions of the stars, the positions of the stars as a function of time between 92 and 98. And you can see that the stars are definitely moving relative to each other. Just to start off talking about the motions of the stars slightly further away from the galactic centre, here is a few second scale image of the galactic centre. The centre is just here, and these arrows, you can see these yellow arrows indicate the proper motion, the motion that you get by taking snapshots of the centre and seeing the stars actually moving. You can see that there appears to be a systematic clockwise motion. Most of these arrows about the galactic centre are moving, not all of them, most of them are moving in a clockwise direction. This is from work by Reinhard Genzel and his colleagues. Then you can compare that with radial velocity measurements of these helium-1 stars, which are very bright. They've got radial velocity studies, and most of the ones up here you can see with blue dots, which indicate the motion. They are coming towards us. Most of the ones with red dots are moving away from us. There appears to be a systematic motion. So you can see that most of the ones above here are coming towards us. Most of the ones below are going away. There is a clockwise motion. It all appears to be rather organized. This is a young star cluster, less than about 10 million years old, and it's likely to have formed out of a gas cloud that fell into the galactic center relatively recently. And the fact that it's got all this organized motion, which happens to be counter to the rotation of the galaxy, is probably connected with why it fell in. It's probably a cloud of gas near the galactic center, which for some reason has some spin, which is it's counter-rotating with respect to the galactic center and collided with something else and therefore lost angular momentum and fell in to the center of the galaxy, where it has then formed stars, which luckily we are able to then go and observe and track. Now if we can take the lid off the video, you can actually see these proper motions. Hopefully you can see the proper motions of the stars. There's always a problem with high-tech displays. It was working earlier. Is it obvious? We'll give it just a few seconds to see if it can. There is something.
Just set it up one of
them. Yeah. Put a cap on it. Oh dear. Should we give up, Mitch?
That is whether the machine is the computer or not.
Yeah.
It should be on.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, good. Wonderful.
Okay, let's put this one to sleep. Good.
Yes.
I have never used it before until yesterday. Okay.
Good. These are the stars in the galactic center. You will see the date up here. It's 1992.70. This is Sag A star, the center of the galaxy. And what you should see once the movie starts is you can see the motion of the stars around the galactic center. Okay? And there's the time up here. And you can see that they're like a swarm of bees around the center. And you're genuinely seeing this motion, which is presumably induced by the very high mass that there is there. And notice that this star, this one here, is moving fastest of all. It's traveling at about 1400 kilometers per second. And as you get further away, so some of the stars are moving, but the motions are certainly smaller. And certainly as one analyzes the motions in an image like this and many other images, the velocities appear to go roughly as r to the minus a half, which is what you expect, assuming there's a point mass at the center. Thanks very much, Nitch. I'm always very hesitant about high-tech displays of things, so going back now to view graphs, just showing what you've already seen. This plot came from Andrea Goetz, UCLA, and you can see the pictures, the previous ones were from telescopes in Chile run by ESO. This is from the Keck telescope, the central arc second or so around the galactic center, which is about here. And what you can see, hopefully, is that this star is moving down, down, down. You can see the sequence of images there, definitely motions around the galactic center. And the summary picture of the motions is here. This is the 1998 plot here. You can see that this star is definitely moving very fast at about 1400 kilometers per second. Just to remind you, we're going around the Sun at 30 kilometers per second. We're going around the center of the galaxy at about 230 kilometers per second. So this is a very high velocity compared to ordinary motions within our galaxy. And that star moving around V404 Sig was going around at plus or minus 200 kilometers per second. So this must be one of the highest velocity stars, if not the highest velocity star in our galaxy. It's moving like that. The interesting thing so far is that no acceleration has been measured in this. And this suggests that this star, for example, is on some sort of radial plunging orbit across the galactic center. It's probably come from far out and is plunging through and is not in some sort of simple little closed circular orbit down there. But nevertheless, you can still use it to work out the mass of the central object here. So what people have done, Genzel's group and Goetz's group, have put all the data together and work out what the mass is at the center of our galaxy. This pretty picture from Reinhard Genzel summarizes everything. This is the mass enclosed within a particular radius, radial distance from Sag A star, the radio source which lies at the center of the galaxy. As you get out at, say, 10 parsecs or so, 30 light years, then you find there's a very large mass. As you get closer and closer, it gets less. That's because there's an extended star cluster around the galactic center. We're getting closer to the center, but then everything levels out within a parsec, and we see that we're leveling out, coming at a central mass of around 2.6 times 10 to the 6, 2.6 million solar masses. This is essentially that star, which is a very high velocity star. The blue points are from Andrea Goetz, the yellow points from Genzel's work, and then we've got other estimates of velocity and studies further out. So this is a combination of work which comes both from radial velocity studies and of proper motion studies, proper motion being the movement of the positions of stars across the sky. All of these studies coincide, indicating that well within, shall we say, a hundredth of a parsec, there is some mass, which is 2.6 million solar masses. And the only plausible thing that one can stick in there is a black hole. This is sort of limiting star cluster that one can put in there. And if you start studying what such a star cluster would do, all the stars would be colliding with each other within a very short time. It's a very plausible possibility. This is the summary, again from Genzel, of the central dark mass. 2.5 million solar masses. These are the statistical and systematic uncertainties on that. The density is around 10 to the 12 solar masses per cubic parsec, an extremely high density. The core radius is less than 7 milliparsecs, less than 8 light days. We're dealing with a very compact object, and if you model it as some sort of star cluster, it's got to drop off very rapidly in density with radius. And the mass-to-light ratio of this central region is more than 100 in solar units, so it's certainly a very compact object. Then when we look at the radio source in the galactic centre, you find that it appears to be essentially stationary, it's not moving around, and you get the proper motion of that object is less than 50th of the motion of the stars, and you can think about equipartition arguments arguing that whatever is in the centre also has to have a very high mass, maybe not from equipartition quite as high as this, but you're dealing with a very compact object. And finally on this, just the comment that the radio source is seen to be very small, arguments about precisely what its size and masses, its size and dimensions are, we'll hear about that in some of these workshops, but it's comparable to, say, around 10 source star radii. Just a summary now on the galactic centre. There's excellent evidence for a massive black hole in the galactic centre. It's very clear that there is something right in the middle of about 2.5 million solar masses, lots of evidence from different directions. There is a puzzle to do with the galactic centre, and that is that its total luminosity, if we look at how much power is coming out of this black hole, it's virtually nothing, all the way from the radio to gamma ray regime. We've got a radio source, there's an X-ray source, but it's very low luminosity. This is possibly solved by ADAF models, advection-dominated accretion flow models, such as Professor Narayan and others have pursued for some years, and those models require that the central mass has an event horizon. The black hole has to accrete both the mass and energy. In other words, we expect that that black hole has got matter falling into it, and that matter falling into it would, if there were not an event horizon, if we were dealing with a solid object in the middle, we would get a lot of luminosity out of this. However, these models are somewhat debatable at the current time, and I know that Mitch Beagleman, who's going to follow me, is going to talk further about this. But nevertheless, I don't think that he is going to say we're not dealing with a black hole at the galactic centre. So I think this is excellent evidence that we've got a black hole at the centre of our galaxy of 2.5 million solar masses. To move on to another excellent example, this is NGC 4258, it's a nearby galaxy to us, but much more distant than the galactic centre. It's also known as M106. Let's look at these pictures of NGC 4258 moving from the bottom to the top. This is a radio image of the galaxy. You can see some funny sort of spiral-like jets or plumes coming out of the galactic centre. When you look with very large, very long baseline interferometry at the galactic, the centre of this galaxy, the nucleus is here, there's some sort of radio source looking like that. But what was found was that at particular wavelengths, there is a water maser operating in the centre of this galaxy, a water maser which has got these little, at these particular spot positions across here. Here is a radio spectrum, this little bit here is a radio spectrum of that source. So there's emission from the centre here, and at these different positions you've got water maser emission. And because it's a water maser, because it's maser emission, one can measure the frequency very precisely, you've got the positions very precisely of all this material, and one can therefore measure a radial velocity curve. You can work out what the velocity of the water the masing material is as a function of distance across the galaxy. We're dealing here with the within the inner parsec, within the inner few light years around the nucleus of the galaxy, and what is found is on this side the motions are very high, around 1500 kilometers per second. On this side, from Doppler shifts, the velocity is around minus 500 kilometers per second, and more than that, that these velocities of the individual water masers follow extremely well onto a Keplerian law. So the evidence is that we're dealing with material which is in orbit around the center of that galaxy, around the nucleus. We are measuring the velocities of this material, and it's following Kepler's law extremely well. It's likely that the water maser is only seen out here and here and here just because of line of sight requirements to get the water maser to operate. All of this, when one ties it together, gives extremely good evidence that we've got a black hole in the center of this system of around 30 million solar masses. So again, another excellent example that we're dealing with a massive black hole at the center of one of these galaxies. A couple more examples before I move into the X-ray side. This is an old example of a nearby galaxy in the Virgo cluster, M87, of looking at the center of this galaxy at gas which is swirling around the nucleus. This is done with a Hubble Space Telescope. There is now better results than this, but this is just a simple picture of it, that the material over here from optical emission lines is moving away from us. The material here is approaching us. The velocities are plus and minus about 1,000 kilometers per second, so consequently we know that there's orbital motion around the center of that object. When you take the velocities and the distances involved, you get masses of around 3 billion solar masses. As we're working out, so we're going up in the mass of the black hole, and that's really also combined with the sensitivity. Of course, as you go further away, in a sense, to actually resolve things, you need very high velocities in order that you can tell what you're dealing with. And the final one on this is just looking at the galaxy M84, where a slit was placed across here, and as you go up the slit, so the velocity of the emission line moves across to the red, goes to the blue, and then goes back again. You've got this very clear Doppler shift that you can see, and this Doppler shift, again, around plus or minus 1,000 kilometers per second, indicates that in the middle of this object, there's a black hole with a mass of around 300 million solar masses. So, very good evidence that we're dealing with black holes. I would, however, say that this is a false color image before you run away and think, wow, this is absolutely amazing. The stuff has shifted from the yellow to the red, and then shifted across to the violet, and back to... Okay. This isn't quite true. Indeed, if you were to represent it in true color, your eye could not resolve the color difference between there and there. This is just a false color amplification of what's seen, but you get the point. If indeed there were velocities like that, if we were able to see stuff so close that the velocities went from the red to the blue, there would be all sorts of other relativistic effects which would screw this thing up and make it much more complicated. I'm about to get on and tell you about that. So the evidence so far, which we've got, is that there is, I think it's very clear, robust evidence that there are massive compact objects at the middle of many active many galaxies, and I'll summarise that a little bit more right at the end. And also that when we look at black hole candidate sources in the galaxy, like Cygnus X1, V404 Cygni, that we're dealing with stellar mass black holes. But just in terms of what we're looking at, I've got it plotted there in terms of gravitational radii, where a gravitational radius is gm over c squared. And what you see is all of these observations are coming from about 100,000 gravitational radii. They're not really probing strong gravity. That's where the observation is made. And indeed, this is roughly where the solar surface is. We're not probing gravitational fields much stronger than the surface of the sun. So if you want to go and see the kind of gravitational field that these things are sampling, you can go out and look at the sun, and you're seeing something similar. They're not really telling us about the properties of black holes, testing the strong field properties of black holes. When we look at the data on many of these objects, we do see all sorts of evidence, particularly with the black hole sources. We see oscillations, variability, and so forth in the X-ray, which indicates we're dealing with very small sizes and probably coming from down here. There are all sorts of plausible arguments which suggest that a lot of the emission is coming from way down here. But I'm not, in this talk, going to review all those examples because they aren't in the sense that you can lead through very simply in a way that maybe a string theorist would grasp every nuance that we're talking about. And I know that we, in our astrophysical conferences, are going to hotly debate many of those issues. So I hope those of you who know all about these things and have got lots of wonderful data will excuse me if I now don't talk any further about oscillations or disk radii and so forth, and I'm now going to tell you about the ion line. The thing is that what I want to do is to talk about observations and the evidence for black holes from systems which aren't such clean black holes, but where matter is falling into them. These are the things for which black holes first came into astronomy in the 60s, where we thought there was very good evidence for black holes, and these are the active galactic nuclei, which include quasars. They're objects which have very high powers, and often are extremely variable. These are some old X-ray light curves, where you can see the X-rays varying around. So we're dealing with things which are very luminous. They typically have luminosities of, shall we say, 10 to the 10 times the luminosity of the Sun, and yet they vary on a time scale of maybe 100 seconds. If you've got something with a luminosity of 10 to the 10 times that of the Sun, then from radiation pressure arguments, you can argue that you've got a very large mass holding everything together. And if you see a variation in 100 seconds or 1,000 seconds, from causality you're dealing with something very small. Lots of evidence, lots of suggestive evidence, we're dealing with a black hole. When you compare what you see spectrally as well, you're seeing X-rays, that's the kind of thing that you would expect from matter which is falling into a black hole. When you're very close to a black hole, you don't expect to see individual stars, because any individual stars would have been either tidally stripped out of existence, or they would have collided or something like that. You certainly do not expect to see a water maser coming from 10 Schwarzschild radii or something like that, because things are going to be much too energetic, much too hot. So when you go and look very close to the black hole, one of the best things to do might be to look at X-ray sources. Now, I'm not in this talk either, and I'll just mention it, I'm not going to talk about gravitational wave studies, for which there's great potential in the next few decades, but I'm now going to concentrate on talking on these about these X-ray results. And just as a this is just to compare the X-ray variability, the qualitatively what the X-ray variability from an active galactic nucleus, where probably the black hole mass is 100 million solar masses, with a black hole candidate like Cygnus X1, where the mass of a black hole is maybe 10 to 20 solar masses. Hopefully you can see some sort of qualitative similarity between these light curves. The biggest difference, of course, is the time scale. That's 1 second, and that's 1 day. But this is probably 20 solar masses. This is 100 million solar masses. So the two things roughly scale, and we expect the time scales to scale roughly as the mass, something like that. Although I would say, at the moment, we do not understand the nature of this variability. What I'm going to do and assume in what follows is that this variability is caused mainly by X-ray flares, magnetic flaring above material which is in an accretion disk. When you accrete matter into a black hole, it's likely that the material accreting has got some angular momentum around the black hole, and then dissipation, if indeed the material is able to dissipate, dissipation then causes the material to flatten into a disk, and you get in the strong shearing motions, magnetic fields are amplified and you generate magnetic flares. At least that's the supposition I'm going to make. And I'll just remind you by showing you this picture of the Sun from the Yoko satellite. This is what the Sun looks like in X-rays. It's a very weak X-ray source, but because it's so close we can make lovely pictures and images of it. This is the X-ray Sun. You can't see the solar surface, but what you do see are all these flaring regions above, active regions strictly speaking, within which flares take place, where magnetic fields which have been amplified by the differential rotation of the Sun reconnect and magnetic energy gets turned into radiant energy. So that's the kind of configuration. This is a spherical situation. Now take this spherical differentially rotating situation, make it into a disk around the black hole, wind up all of the powers and everything. In terms of the X-ray Sun, you've got to wind the power up by about a factor of 10 to the 16, wind up all the differential motions and so forth by very large factors. That's the kind of situation that I'm talking about. In that case, the X-ray emission, when it goes off, is going to give rise to something rather interesting. Here is the most of the material going round is going to form a rather optically thick disk. By optically thick, I mean it's going to be rather dense and flattened and photons are going to be absorbed by it. If we get an X-ray flare taking place above that disk material, we, the observer, are going to see X-rays directly, and also the X-rays from the flare are going to irradiate the surface of the disk. And in so doing, we're going to give rise to what we call a reflected spectrum. I'll keep talking about the reflection spectrum. It doesn't obey the laws of reflection. It's really a backscattered emission. And this kind of emission is also seen off the surface of the sun when an X-ray flare takes place. So we see direct emission and we see the reflected emission. What do we expect the reflected emission to look like? This is a Monte Carlo plot by Chris Reynolds of photon energy now going across in the energy in the X-ray band. And here we've got the counts going up. The direct emission is likely to be pretty much a power law spectrum. This is produced by comptonization, thermal comptonization of the energy within the flare. The magnetic energy goes into hot electrons. The hot electrons then scatter, inelastically scatter, the soft photons, the UV photons that happen to be around, and turn them into X-ray photons, and you end up with this power law continuum spectrum. Then, when it irradiates the surface, at energies above about 30 kV, electron scattering dominates, and you get a very high albedo. But at low energies, photoelectric absorption is important, and the continuum is very weak. But nevertheless, because of you absorbing the photons, there is a possibility of getting fluorescence. By that I mean, for example, taking the case of iron, the photon at, say, 8 kV gets absorbed by an iron atom, and kicks out the K-shell electron, then an L-shell electron drops down, and you get an emission line coming out. And this emission line, fluorescent emission line, is likely to be strong. The fluorescence yield goes as the atomic number to the fourth power, so we expect iron to be a particularly strong source of fluorescent photons. Therefore, what we would expect from this region, we do expect a spectral feature. We expect the spectral feature due to iron. We expect an iron emission line from material which is accreting into a black hole. And if we can see that iron emission line, it's like having a clock, which is from very few gravitational radii, and therefore we can start to study what's going on down there. This is what I use for undergraduates. Forgive me for explaining what's going on, what sort of shape of line you expect, but here is a black hole. Here is a disk of material going around the black hole. If we just had Newtonian physics, then of course what you expect is a completely symmetrical line which is higher at the edges than in the center. This is frequency coming across here, so this is a spectrum of the line. You expect the inner parts of the disk to give rise to the broader parts of the line, the outer parts of the disk, because they're moving slower, the inner parts of the line. If we then put in special relativity, because we're going around a black hole, then this part is moving towards us close to the speed of light. This is going away. You expect special relativity to boost the blue horn, as we call it, and reduce the red horn due to aberration. And you also expect time aberration as well. Moving clocks run slow, shift everything a bit to the left. Add in general relativity, you've got a deep potential well, therefore gravitational redshift can be a large effect. Everything from the inner parts gets shifted to the left. The net result is you get a broad, skewed line. Note also that E goes as 1 over R. Most of the power is given out near the center, so it's going to be this part which is going to be the brightest part. Well, we worked on possible line profiles back 10 years ago, and this is the predicted shapes, and it all depends upon the inner radius, the outer radius of the emission, the inclination of the disk, and the emissivity law. But a key thing to note about this are that the edge of the blue wing is telling you the inclination more than anything else. The edge of the red wing is telling you how close you are to the black hole. Now this next little view graph shows you, just emphasizing the line shape again, this is what you expect for an inclination of 30 degrees, which means the disk is inclined rather almost face on. This is 60 degrees where it's inclined much more steeply. You therefore get more of a Doppler effect, and the line, this blue horn, the high energy horn, is shifted more to the right, and the inner radius is in the assumptions here is much the same. You can get the inner radius to go in if you have a Kerr black hole, which takes the inner radius of the disk in from 6m down towards the event horizon. I wouldn't be showing you all that if we hadn't got some possible observations of it. This is showing you the results on MTG6-3015, this an active galaxy, which we took with Asker back in 94, published in 95. These are the spectrum. This is just the spectrum as we get it out of the detector, essentially. And what is fit there is between up to about 5 keV and above 7 keV, we fit the best power law that works for these data. And you can see that when you compare that power law with the data, there is a large residual offset around about between 5 and 6.5 keV. If you then take that difference and turn it into a line flux, we get something looking like that. So this is photon energy. This is the intensity of the line. What you see there are the data. You can see they're a bit ratty, but nevertheless you can see the data. And the red line is the best fitting model of a relativistic disk. And what we have essentially is emission from material between 6 and about 40 gravitational radii, with an emissivity law which is plausible for emission of, from a disk falling into a black hole. The inclination is 30 degrees. Note how abruptly the edge drops just there. And this, where this dies into the noise, is telling us the inner radius, and this is telling us the inclination. And it's a fair fit for the data. I wouldn't claim we actually detect this second peak, but nevertheless you can see it's sort of plausible there. So this is perhaps evidence of emission, and it gives us a handle, a diagnostic of what's happening to material which is at a few, around 10 gravitational radii or so. Just to give you a, this is the galaxy we were looking at, this one here, clearly not a very exciting galaxy optically. The results from that have been confirmed by another satellite which is in orbit at the moment, called BepoSax, an Italian-Dutch satellite, and this is their observation of the same galaxy. This time they have three separate detector systems, and they can see it from 0.1 to 100 kV. They've fitted it with a power law, and this is the best fitting power law with some absorption features that you require to put in. And what they see too are some weird residuals around the energies I was showing you, and they're amplified there. And in their paper they say, to quote them, that there is remarkable agreement between their results and the results that came from the Asker satellite. We also observed this object back in 97 again, and we find that the time average line profile between 94 and 97 is very similar. In red, you've got the data from 94, which I've shown you already. In green, you've got the data from 97, and you can see how they coincide. The point I'm trying to tell you is that this line profile is robust, at least on a time average sense, and it appears to indicate that most of the action from this object is coming from around 6 to 40 or 50 gravitational radii. We can see, also see evidence for the rest of the reflection spectrum. This is from work by Julia Lee using RXTE, the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer data, which has a high energy experiment and a middle experiment. This is the Asker data overlaid on it in colour, and you can see that the relative, the iron line, the effects of the reflection coming through, this is a coded plot for the astronomers, so if you don't understand all the wiggles in it, don't worry too much. The point being that we can actually see the effects of the reflection of the continuum in this thing, by looking carefully at the continuum spectrum. And just to say it, that when we work everything out, this is a complicated plot, and all I will say is when you look at it and you mess around with all the possible abundances you can have, and whether you smear the reflection spectrum or not, the evidence is consistent with omega equals 2 pi. In other words, the X-ray flares are irradiating something which is flat. It's also consistent with it being slightly bowl-shaped as well. But just to come down to what the shape of the continuum under the line is, it's likely because in the reflection we get also there's a certain amount of absorption. You've got to blur the absorption as well as the emission and so forth. And the net effect is it's likely that 10 or 20% of the line itself, this is a model now, 10 or 20% of the line is taken up by deviations in the continuum. I won't go any more into the details of that, but that's just to show you that we're pursuing every possibility that we can find with regard to it. And that object, MCG6 3015, is not the only object which shows a broad iron line. There are many, and say several dozen. And Paul Nandra has looked at all the data that was available back in 97, added them all together, and you can see this is all of the data, and this is all minus MCG6 and another bright object. You can see that most of these objects show a peak somewhere around here, and there is evidence for a large red wing in many of these objects. The point of showing you that is merely that I'm not showing you just one unique object, but many of these particular class of objects called Seyfert galaxies appear to show the broad iron line. And this is it, just a summary on where I've got to so far, that in MCG6 3015 we can see an X-ray diagnostic from around 6 to 40 gravitational radii. The broad iron line is seen in many Seyfert 1 galaxies. It's also seen in Seyfert 2 galaxies. It's seen in some radio galaxies, but generally it is not seen in radio quiet quasars. So when you go to more luminous objects, the so-called quasars, you do not see this broad iron line. I don't wish to go into all the details about that, nor is it seen in the black hole candidates clearly. That there is something going on in the black hole candidates, I don't wish to get into those details here and now. The broad iron line results from ASCA have been confirmed by Sachs observations. Okay, so far, I said it was due to flares above an accretion disk. What do we expect as those flares change? We expect there to be changes in the profile of this emission line as a flare changes. So, for example, if we've got the accretion disk and a flare takes place on the approaching side of the disk, we expect there to be a blue-shifted line, or a line near the rest energy, compensating for the gravitational redshift. If a flare occurs on the receding side of the disk, you expect to see it on low energy, and if the flare occurs near the center of the disk, we expect also to see it redshifted because of gravitational redshift. Do we see any such effects? The answer is yes. During 94, the data did something like this. It showed a minimum and it showed a maximum, a flare, and the shape of the line was different here, and was much the same in all the rest of the times. And just briefly to show you there, during the flare, the line just appeared to be a blue horn. During the minimum, the flare, the line profile appeared to have a very large red wing. This is possibly due to the fact that during the flare occurred on the approaching side of the disk. So this can be explained as a flare, as a bright flare on the approaching side of the disk. This is, I mean, we can argue about the details of some of these things. And here we're dealing with a flare which occurred possibly within 6M, because the evidence is that there is a large red wing to this line, and that could only be explained by making the disk extend within 6M. And the way in which the disk can extend within 6M is to make the disk, the black hole spin, so this could be evidence that we're dealing with a spinning black hole. And this is the fit to a spinning black hole disk line to the data of that particular chunk of data. There is some, one can start arguing about the real details of what's going on here, and indeed the evidence is only tentative because you can see the quality of the error bars, but the key point I want to get over to you is that we can start arguing about what is happening to material which is at around about 10 gravitational radii, or within 10 gravitational radii, using data of the quality that I've been showing you. During 1997, we looked at the object again, and I've spoken about this. Here is a light curve from RXTE, a light curve from ASCA, and you can see that there was a large flare seen this time in the ASCA data. This large flare also showed a strange ion line profile. Here it is. During the flare that occurred in 97, the line appears to show just a bump around 5 kV. It does not appear to show any profile around the rest energy of the line. In the standard line, this is what happened just a few hours later, the line appears to look quite different. The point to obtain from this plot that I'm showing you here is that the line appears definitely to change with time, and during the flare it looks something like this. What one can then do is to fit this line profile with various possibilities, and just to summarize them, that this line profile can be fit by matter from a disk around a Kerr black hole, where we're dealing with matter at around 5m. That's the best explanation of what's going on there. So it's likely that in this situation, we're dealing with a disk around a spinning black hole. So in MCG 6-3015, we've got a spinning black hole, a disk around a spinning black hole. We've got flares above that disk, and sometimes, most of the time, the flares are occurring between 6 and 40 or 50 gravitational radii. Sometimes the flares move into smaller radii, I don't know why, and give rise to evidence which is telling us that we're dealing with a Kerr black hole. Very briefly now, on to the future, which Mitch will also take up on. Can we actually measure time delays from between continuum variability? If we see the continuum vary, and then we see the ion line vary, there's the exciting possibility from those time delays we can convert them into sizes, and we can therefore work out mass measurements and actually do detailed mapping of the near environment of black holes using this ion line. At the moment, using ASCA data, we only get a few hundred photons from the ion line per day. And we're dealing with a source which changes dramatically within an hour, and less than an hour. So clearly we're not going to do this kind of reverberation using the current instruments. But over the next year, with XMM, for example, we expect to get the aperture to increase by an order of magnitude, and there are instruments proposed, such as Constellation X, where they'll increase by two orders of magnitude, and this kind of work is going to become possible. What might we expect to see? Well, just to remind you about what might happen when a flare takes place above a disk. Here's an accretion disk, here's the black hole, a flare takes place here. Just so far as the outside observer is concerned, these are what the wavefronts of the light from the flare appear to do. This is just the time delay caused by the strong gravitational field of the black hole. What you expect is, in Newtonian space, this would just be spherical wavefronts, and you would expect to see a single wavefront move across the accretion disk. But because we've got a black hole in the center, it gets buckled like this, and what you expect to see is a wavefront moving out, and also a wavefront moving in. And in the movie that Mitch will show, you'll see this very clearly. I just want to show the pretty picture that Andy Young has made, which shows you what the shape of that wavefront is going to be. It gets wrapped around the black hole like this. This is the approaching side of the black hole, the receding side of the black hole, and so forth. And so these are kind of effects which we can measure, because of the way we measure them is because of we're able, from the ion line, to measure both the energy and the time, and you expect the line coming from close to the black hole will have a low energy. The line moving further out has got a higher energy. And the last plot I'm going to show before summarize the summary view graph is just some work by my student Matthias, Rushkovsky, who's actually studied a flare above a disk where the flare is orbiting the disk. And these are just, if you just glance at them as pretty pictures, see that they will be rich in information from such a flare, because there's a whole collection of effects taking place here involving gravitational light bending, gravitational time delay, gravitational redshifting that we should, in the next 10 years, be able to see. Okay, last few graph, while the chairman gets very fancy. The summary of what I've been trying to tell you is that black holes are common, both stellar mass ones and supermassive ones. The data on the mass of black holes is robust. That's where we have the masses of black holes from nearby galactic nuclei and stellar mass objects within our own galaxy and maybe some of the nearest ones, the masses appear to be very robust. We shall hear this afternoon from Doug Richstone about a census of work on black holes in nearby nuclei where we can measure masses. And the result is that most nearby galaxies have got black holes in them. One tentative result is that the mass of the black hole is around a 200th of the mass of the bulge in that particular object. We can also look and compare the amount of light in the universe, X-rays, infrared and everything else, and it appears that massive black holes are built up by accretion, and the power radiated, if you do a census on this, probably works out that the power from accretion is around about a quarter of the power from stars in the universe. So accretion power is very important within the universe. And finally, I hope in the last part of my talk, I was able to show you that the broad iron line is a strong diagnostic of the immediate environment of at least some black holes. Thank you.
On your last geographic, you said they're built up by accretion.
Yes.
Do you mean that's how they actually, that the galaxy comes first and then the black hole, or is that just after you have a massive black hole, it gets built up?
As you just said, after we've got a black hole, quite how the black hole forms in the first place, I don't know, and we will no doubt debate that in one of these sessions. But once you've got a black hole, then it's accretion which builds up most of the mass of the black hole. But one of the exciting aspects to study over the next few years is whether it's the black hole comes first, then the galaxy, or does the galaxy and the black hole form together in a deep potential well, or do we form galaxies and then later do we form massive black holes at the center?
Why you don't see these obscure lines in stellar mass black holes?
Excellent question. My own ideas at the moment are connected with the fact that it's likely that the disks in stellar mass black holes are ionized. As you go down to lower mass systems, so the temperature of the disk gets higher and higher, as you know, and this tends to make them more ionized. But the precise details, why everything doesn't scale, I don't know, and I can only appeal to more and more observations. When we do look at some of the stellar mass black holes in some of their states, because they show many different states, you do see evidence for absorption and emission features which indicate you're dealing with things at, say, between 10 and 100 gravitational radii. So something down there is coming and telling us all these things, but I didn't want to go through what is rather a messy story.
You mentioned you have evidence for a Kerr black hole, but you didn't say anything much about how fast it might be rotating. And could you say more details about what the structure of this thing is? I mean, presumably the slower it's rotating, more.
Is this grid sort of like a...
Yes. In the particular example I showed you, I'm just trying to find, here we are, in this example, that is a maximally spinning black hole with an A of 0.998, A over M of 0.998, which is, according to Kip Thorne's work back in the 70s, likely to be the most massive, most rapidly spinning black hole you can get. People in the audience will immediately jump on me if I say that this is conclusive evidence that this is a rapidly spinning black hole. I want to show this as an example of how it's probably a spinning black hole. Mitch Beagleman, who's going to talk next with Chris Reynolds, has produced an alternative picture of that, which he's not going to talk about. And I and Andy Young and Randy Ross have hopefully got rid of their model. So again, it's a rather complex situation I don't wish to go into, but let's say the potential is there for measuring rapidly spinning black holes.
Is that the only candidate so far?
Yes. There is evidence from measurements, indirect measurements of the inner radii of disks in... Good.
And there's 1.93 estimate from that.
Yes. So Mitch Beagleman will go further into the issues about that, you know, where you have one or two examples, and again, some of the astronomers start arguing about the details.
Okay.
Jim.
Can you make some estimate of typical size or minimum size of the flaring region?
Maybe a 100 to 1,000 light seconds across. Comparable to a gravitational radius. Yeah, that kind of size. In some systems they may well be bigger, other systems smaller, but I would put it roughly as gm over c squared. But again, you know, we haven't worked everything out with regard to that. There are all sorts of caveats. Well, what I'm trying to say is that if you model, well, I'm saying that maybe the flare is occurring at 6M.
Well, I think that the speaker is very puzzled. It is, we are talking about either Schwarzschild solution or Kerr solution, in which gravitational radius is 2m, okay? And gravitational radius is something which belongs to the solution. So it is not in coordinates, it is just connected to the mass of the central black hole. That is an invariant measurement of the distance.
And it's derived mainly from, say, the strength of the gravitational redshift that we're measuring. If you like, it's coming from a region which gives rise to a gravitational redshift, which takes the original energy of the line and divides it by two, say. That's how I'm relating it, yeah. From the amount of redshift, this is photon energy. The photons start their energy up here in... locally, and we're observing them down there, almost a factor of two change in frequency. So that's how we're relating it to a radius.
Okay, and that was the last question before the question. We are coming back at 11, and please do remember to sign your name on the four leads for the working group.